facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Wonderful Wednesday to you. It is July the 14th, 2021. So glad that you're with me. 1-888-914-9149 is the number to call. The toll-free line to get to me on the Cale Clark Show. You can also tweet at me, at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. And the show account is at Cale Clark Show. You're going to want to follow that one too. The email address, cale at relevantradio.com, C-A-L-E at relevantradio.com. And that's a great place to send us questions that you have about the Catholic faith, stuff you'd like us to talk about on the program, comments, your thoughts. You can email me. And speaking of email, I have gotten quite a few messages asking me about my take on what's going on with the scandal involving the residential schools, the unmarked graves that have been discovered in Canada. What's my take on that? The church's role in that? And I've held off on that a little bit. I do want to talk a little bit about it today because today's saint, of course, is the first native-born North American saint, Saint Kateri Tekakwitha. And I thought it'd be a good day to talk about this at least a little bit. I'm not ready to talk about it in full. And part of it is because there's still some research that I need to do on this whole issue. And the internet and to some extent talk radio is a place where people often want to shoot from the hip and shoot from the lip, don't they? And there are lots of opinions out there. There is no shortage of them. But very often people's thoughts on a lot of issues are not really well researched. And you know me, you've been listening to the show for a while. You know that I don't like to talk about something unless I think I know what I'm talking about. I don't always completely know what I'm talking about, but I do my homework, I do my research, and I try not to talk about things that I don't know very much about. And so I need to learn much more about this. And I think I especially need to learn about the lived experiences of the indigenous communities that have been affected by these tragedies throughout the decades. And in fact, I do have a friend who's one of my professors who is a First Nations Christian. He comes from a background of one of the First Nations. He is a Christian, of course. He's a biblical scholar. And I need to run him down and talk to him because I know he's got a lot of thoughts on this. And I feel like I need to hear this from an indigenous person's perspective. I want to talk to somebody like my friend, and I'll get back to you on our conversation after we have it on that side of things. I think the other thing that's going on, of course, in the news in relation to this are the church burnings. And I don't know if I have an accurate count, but I believe at least 10 churches in Canada, some of them non-Catholic, but most of them Catholic, have been torched, set on fire. Many more have been vandalized in various ways in retaliation for what's been discovered, the role of the church, and the horrific abuse that happened at these residential schools. And the government has a part to play in this as well. The government mandated that these schools exist and simply enrolled the churches to carry out the plan in some ways. So the government, people like Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, they can't evade apologies for this, and the government's role in this is a lot bigger than a lot of people want to say. But there were incredible injustices committed by Catholics, by priests, by nuns, towards children who are at these schools, some of which I've read about, and quite frankly, some of the stuff I've read is so horrific, I would not even share this in public on the radio. It's so disturbing. And that reality can't be ignored. But I want to talk right now about the issue of the church burnings, and who's really responsible for this. And I think that all people of goodwill should be able to unequivocally condemn these actions. And in fact, to my knowledge, every single indigenous leader, without exception, has condemned these acts, whether they're Christians or not. Some of these indigenous leaders are actually Christians. Many of them are Roman Catholics. Some of them are not. Some of them are opposed to the faith. And one of the churches that was destroyed, was burned, was in my home province of Nova Scotia, Canada, in Indian Brook, and that church was dedicated to today's saint, Saint Kateri Tekakwitha. And her feast day is today in the United States, July 14th. It's April the 17th in Canada. So we'll talk about her today, and I'll tell you about her life story, which is incredibly inspiring on its own. But again, I am no expert on the background of Indigenous peoples in Canada. I know something about it, but not nearly enough. But somebody who does know a lot about it is Terry Glavin. And Terry Glavin, writing for the National Post a few days ago, he talked about, and this was just fascinating to me, he called them Canada's early Christian prophets. And almost like seeds, or really not even seeds of the gospel, but a furrow dug in the fertile soil of North America, preparing the way for the gospel. It's incredible what these pre-Christian prophets talked about to their peoples and how they almost prepared the way for the gospel. I'm going to tell you about that in just a second. But Terry Glavin is an author, a journalist. He wrote for the Ottawa Citizen, still does, and the National Post. He's a contributing editor for Maclean's magazine and is the senior fellow at the Raoul Wallenberg Center for Human Rights. And what he says in his article in the National Post was that for generations of First Nations peoples in British Columbia, and that's the province where a lot of the church burnings happened, where a lot of the residential school graves were found. He says the arrival of Christianity did not occur there when the Oblate missionary James McGuckin came to the area in 1870. In fact, when McGuckin showed up in that vicinity, the people had actually been expecting him. And he was like, "What do you mean?" And McGuckin was told that his visit was expected. It was understood that he would come from, quote-unquote, the land of ghosts. And the people, he was shocked when the people actually made the sign of the cross in front of him, not having been taught it. They knew all about the commandments. They even knew about heaven. How did they know this before a Catholic missionary arrived on the scene? They had heard it from the dreams of a chief, a native chief named Uzcali, who was considered to be a prophet. And he was one of many prophets of the First Nations peoples who had come to acquire the knowledge, at least in part. They didn't know everything, of course, but he gave the people, along with other prophets, this knowledge that the missionaries also wanted to bring. The greatest of all of these prophets, these Native North American prophets, according to Terry Glavin, was someone named Biney. And his story comes to us through the works of several people in the 19th and 20th centuries who collected accounts of his life and work. It is said that miracles were wrought through his hands. We don't know. I can't verify any of that. But a lot of people speculated that his teachings, there's no way that he came up with this on his own. He must have been somehow in contact with other Christian missionaries, perhaps Indigenous evangelists from what is now Oregon, or from devout Métis people who lived east of the Rocky Mountains, or somehow some transit of Catholic ideas from the outer coast. Some people even speculate the Orthodox missionary Innocentius Veniaminov from Russian Alaska is where he got these ideas from. But it doesn't really much matter. According to Terry Glavin, this prophet named Bini, B-I-N-I, is an incredible story. The point is that Indigenous history is a lot more complicated than we realize, and that Indigenous Christians were actually a religion of resistance against colonialism in some ways. A lot of people want to say that really, this Catholicism was used by colonialists to try to subjugate Native peoples, but a lot of Indigenous Christians actually saw their faith as a resistance against European settlement. And there's a scholar at the University of Manitoba named Jason Allen Redden, and he says that Indigenized Christianity was a manifesto, a declaration to the churches and to the allegedly Christian authorities and settlers that you don't own this land. We are entitled to it by our own rights. It's not yours to grab. It's not yours to give. And so This is something that a lot of people have missed, and I have honestly never heard this before. There's so much going on, as Glavin talks about, the quote-unquote burn-it-all-down polemics that have accompanied the torching of the churches that are very sacred to, for example, the Penticton people and many other Native people groups in Canada. And it's obviously been hard to keep count of all the church burnings that have happened. And even non-Indigenous churches have been destroyed. A Vietnamese evangelist church was damaged or destroyed at some level. An African evangelical church in Calgary that serves a congregation that is made up almost entirely of refugees, and also a working class Filipino church in East Vancouver that celebrates Mass in Tagalog, they were also targets of arson. And so there seems to be a kind of an equal opportunity set of attacks on these churches. And a lot of people are saying, well, you know, you guys shouldn't be attacking the non-Catholic churches. You should be attacking only the Catholic churches. That's a lot of the sentiment that's out there. And Terry Glavin says, it is a gross offense against human decency to hold innocently devout Roman Catholics in any way culpable or responsible for long ago crimes committed by Catholic clergymen. Torching a church over those crimes, he says, is no different than smashing synagogue windows over an uproar in Gaza or vandalizing mosques over some wretched thing done by the devotees of the Ayatollah Khomeini in Tehran or the Saudis in Mecca. And I think that's a very good point. And I feel like many people who already have a hatred for the Catholic Church, this has provided them a great opportunity to lash out. And a lot of the perpetrators of these crimes, I don't know the full stats, but quite a few of them are not Indigenous people themselves. There was this curious case, and perhaps you saw this on social media, the case of the quote-unquote Karens who vandalized a church in Vancouver, splashing orange paint all over it. And orange is the color that is has been chosen to represent this mourning, this movement to make reparation for what happened to these Indigenous children in these residential schools. But anyways, these women were wealthy, white, suburbanite women in their Lululemon pants, which cost a lot of money, not exactly who you might expect to be perpetrating these crimes. But there you have it. And this is what Terry Glavin talks about in his article in the National Post. He says, quote, the thing that quite a few self-professed white allies should notice is that not a single Indigenous leader in any of the communities that have become crime scenes has expressed anything less than revulsion and heartbreak over their burned churches. Even leaders, even Indigenous leaders who reject Christianity entirely and actually profess a hatred of the institutions that interned generations of Indigenous children, say they are just as disgusted and dismayed as devout Indigenous Christians are. So a lot of Indigenous Christians obviously depend on these churches. That's where their children were baptized. It's where they were married. A lot of them are Roman Catholics, and some of the churches were destroyed were Anglicans. A lot of Anglican Indigenous people are heartbroken about this as well. All of the chiefs, all of the Indigenous leaders have condemned these church burnings. And this is not the way forward. This is not the way to seek reconciliation. So that's one thing that I wanted to mention about that. I think we can all agree, all people of goodwill would say this is not the way forward. But again, back to what he says about these early prophets who in some way prepared the ground for Christianity. He talked about another prophet in the 1800s, the early 1800s, the Stolo prophet named, and I'm going to butcher this name, I'm sure, Quetzalcanum, I hope I pronounced that right. And he stood on the peak of a mountain, which at the time was known as Taitamamex, which is today a little bit more than an hour's drive east of Vancouver. And this happened at the time of a pandemic of its day in the 1800s, the smallpox disaster that was ravaging the world at the time. And as Glavin puts it, it smashed into the coast civilization like some kind of asteroid, carrying away two out of every three people. The old remedies could not contain the disease. The whole world was convulsing in a kind of moral chaos. You're listening to the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, 1-888-914-9149. Well, Terry Glavin says that this prophet, this indigenous prophet known as Quetzalcanum, had a vision in which three men came to him and showed him how to make the sign of the cross. So as Glavin writes, like Moses coming down from Mount Sinai, Quetzalcanum came down from this mountain with a sort of parchment with symbols on it and instructions on a new way of life that would deliver the people from their suffering. The laws were more or less like the Ten Commandments. So when the Oblate missionaries arrived a few years later, his people saw them coming. They knew who they were. And in fact, some of the Oblate missionaries had been chased out of American territories for quote-unquote siding with the Indians. And people said, oh yeah, when they arrived, oh yeah, we knew you were coming. We've been prepared for this. We understand them. In fact, we already know how to make the sign of the cross. This is unbelievable. And it just reminds me a little bit about what St. Paul did when he went to Athens in the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 17. He quoted pagan poets, pagan writings that all the people would have known to communicate gospel truth. And I don't know whether God spoke to this indigenous prophet in a vision or not, but he may have. He may have. I don't know. But whatever the case may be, they were very receptive when the message of the missionaries came to them. And this is really the part of the time period where St. Kateri Tekakwitha came to know Jesus Christ herself. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about her story. She is the saint of the day after this really, really short message, which we're going to have for you on Relevant Radio. It's the Cale Clark Show. Stick with me. Be right back. 1-888-914-9149. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Explaining the Catholic faith and how you can live it and share it too. It's the Cale Clark Show. Have a question? Give Cale a call at 888-914-9149.
Hey, welcome back to the show. So glad that you're here. It is Wednesday, July the 14th. It's the feast day of the first native-born North American saint, and that is St. Kateri Tekakwitha, the Mohawk mystic of North America. And if you don't know much about her life, I'm going to tell you a little bit about her. A Canadian priest writing in a few years ago in the official newspaper of the Vatican, L'Osservatore Romano, Father Tom Rozica, wrote a nice reflection about her life. And he talked about how, and I'm going to quote extensively from this here, in World Youth Day in 2002 in Toronto, Pope John Paul II, and that was an incredible time in my life because that really started the journey back to the Catholic faith for me in a lot of ways, the Pope coming to Toronto. I'll tell you about that another time. But the closing event of that World Youth Day was the Pope addressing a massive throng of young people who were at the Downsview Air Force Base on Sunday, the 28th of July, 2002, at the concluding mass. And here's what Pope John Paul II, St. John Paul II, said during his homily. He said, at difficult moments in the Church's life, the pursuit of holiness becomes even more urgent. And holiness is not a question of age. It is a matter of living in the Holy Spirit, just as Kateri Tekakwitha did here in America and so many other young people have done. Now, she was only 24 years old, by the way, St. Kateri, when she went to heaven. And it's intriguing that for his last World Youth Day, it's the last one that he ever did, St. John Paul II singled out this young native woman. And he had offered her up as one of the, there were nine saints and blesseds that JP2 offered up as patrons of World Youth Day in 2002. And her story is one that a lot of people weren't that familiar with. Why did she become a Catholic? What was the source of her love for Christ and the church? She lived, of course, in the 17th century. How does her life speak to people today? And obviously, when she was canonized, by the way, she was canonized in 2012, in October of 2012, by Pope Benedict. And a lot of people at the time were both in various communities, in indigenous communities, they're really excited about her canonization because they thought that it might help to bring about healing between the church and indigenous communities that had suffered a lot, obviously, at the hands of the church, and we know even more about that now. And we need to ask for her prayers for reconciliation evermore, because of this history of oppression and abuse, and unfortunately members of the church were involved with that. So let's talk about her life. Now, most of what we know about her comes from biographies that were written by two Jesuit priests who actually knew her personally, and they prayed with her often. They were actually presiding over the mission where she lived, and their names are Father Pierre Cholinec and Father Claude Chochetiere. Oh, man, I find at this time of the day, my brain is not firing on all cylinders. Early in the morning, I'm super sharp, and anyways, I can barely even speak right now. But these priests, these Jesuit priests, Father Pierre Cholinec and Father Claude Chochetiere, there we go. This almost sounds Italian there. I think I did that wrong. Thanks, Lucas. He was French. He wasn't Italian. Anyways, their accounts of St. Kateri's life are quite instructive. Now, she is known as, her nickname was the Lily of the Mohawks. She was born in 1656 at Acernanon, which was an Iroquois village on the Mohawk River, and that is located in what is now New York State. The town today is known as Oriusville, and that's where there's a martyr shrine. The early North American martyrs, Jesuit priests and their friends, missionaries who came, and they were... Many of them paid for this with their lives, and we all know the stories of Saint Jean de Brébeuf, who was brutally tortured, and in fact, his killers actually, he was so brave under torture that they actually ate his heart. Not to gross you out, after they killed him, because they wanted what he had, that the bravery, the ability to endure, and of course that was endurance given to him as a grace by God for the sake of the gospel. And St. Isaac Jogues, these were brilliant scholars. These were the cream of the crop, the best of the best, you know, to borrow a line from Top Gun, the elite, the best of the best. And they gave it all up to be missionaries in what is now North America, Canada, the United States. And it was then, of course, you know, under British and French control. And so St. Isaac Jogues, he was tortured. His fingers were cut off. They did that so he couldn't celebrate Mass properly. He went back to France. First thing he said when he got there was, "When can I go back to the New World? Are you kidding? They just tried to kill you. I want to go back." And he eventually was martyred as well. So that all happened around this time. Well, St. Kateri, her father was actually a Mohawk chief. Her mother was actually a Catholic. She was one of the early converts. She was a Catholic from the Algonquin tribe. And at the age of four, the smallpox pandemic, which was, of course, the great pandemic of that time, attacked her village. Her parents died. Her baby brother died of smallpox. She almost died. She became an orphan. Smallpox had ravaged her body. She had marks from the smallpox, permanent scars from the smallpox all over her face. And she became very much visually impaired, near blind, because of the smallpox. But she survived, and she was adopted by her aunt and her uncle, who was also a Mohawk chief. And what they did was that the family actually abandoned their old village, and they built a new settlement 5 miles away on the north bank of the Mohawk River, which today is located in Fonda, New York. And Kateri Tekakwitha was not baptized when she was an infant. Despite the fact that her mother was a Catholic, she did not get baptized when she was young. But even though her mother died when she was only 4 years old, she somehow had retained some memories of the prayers of her mother, stories that she told her when she was quite small. And somehow that stuck with her. And she would often, as she was growing up as a young woman, she would go into the woods alone just to speak to God, to pray, and commune with him somehow in nature. But when she was 18 years old, Father de Lamberville, who was a Jesuit missionary, came to her settlement and he started a chapel. Her uncle greatly disliked this guy. The Jesuit missionaries were known as the Black Robes. There's been several movies made about them that are quite good. And he thought this was a strange new religion. He didn't like it at all, but he did tolerate the missionaries, let them stay there. And she, Kateri, got to know this guy, and she was fascinated by the stories that she heard about Christ. She wanted to become a Christian, and in fact, this Jesuit persuaded the uncle, the chief of the village, to allow Kateri to attend basically the RCIA program, religious instruction. And the following Easter, Kateri was baptized, and that's where she got her name. The name Kateri actually is the Mohawk way of saying Catherine. And I believe that she took the name after Catherine of Siena, St. Catherine of Siena. So Catherine in Mohawk is Kateri. So, and her Iroquois name means the one who places things in order. The one who places things in order. And we need her to pray for order and reconciliation today. So she became incredibly devout. She underwent a lot of voluntary mortifications, and some of the stuff is pretty extreme. She would deliberately expose herself to the cold, obviously these harsh winters in that part of the world. She would actually take burning coals and actually put them on her legs and burn her legs, and she would even pierce her skin with thorns in a way to try to imitate the suffering of Christ. Now, this is not recommended. This is not recommended. The church would never be cool with penances that actually harm your physical body. But we have to admit that throughout history, some saints, out of an overabundance of zeal, have undergone incredibly harsh penances, mortifications on themselves, and that's what she did. And this was a tough environment. She grew up in, as Father Ruzica explains, she grew up in a time of colonialism, war, not only raging between the settlers and the native North American tribes, but also between the tribes themselves. The Algonquin nation, the Iroquois nation, were constantly at war. And she became, St. Kateri became, after she was baptized at the age of 20, she became the village outcast. Nobody wanted to talk to her. Her family actually refused to give her food on Sundays because she wouldn't work on Sunday. She observed the Sabbath rest, and she became persecuted for that. Children would taunt her in the streets. They'd throw stones at her. She was threatened with being tortured or being killed if she didn't renounce Catholicism. Well, things became eventually so hostile that she had to flee. And in July of 1677, St. Kateri left her village, and she fled more than 200 miles. Without a car, by the way. This is all through the woods, on foot, through woods, rivers, swamps. She somehow eventually made it to the Catholic mission of St. Francis Xavier at Sault Ste. Louis, which is near Montreal, modern-day Montreal. In her journey through the wilderness, by the way, this took over 2 months for her to get there. From what is now New York State to Montreal, what is now Quebec. And she was allowed to receive, because of her incredible devotion to the faith, she was allowed to receive her first Holy Communion on Christmas Day in the year 1677. And she actually moved into a cabin which belonged to someone named Anastasia. And she was also a native North American who had become a Catholic. And so Anastasia, of course, the name Anastasia means the resurrection in Greek, so that's kind of cool. It's my daughter's middle name, too. And she moved in with this Christian woman, Anastasia, and that was really beneficial to her, to have that companionship and have kind of a sister in the faith. And she began to pray. She would go into the woods and made this little chapel in the woods for herself to commune with God. She would make crosses out of sticks and kind of plant them out in the woods and make almost like a way of the cross that she could go to and pray at these various stations. And she always prayed the rosary. She helped to teach the young. And even at this time, though, there were a ton of pressures on her of another sort, too. She was kind of persecuted for her faith, had to flee to this place. And then another pressure started to come upon her from people around her, and that was marriage, the pressure to marry. And on the 25th of March, on the Feast of the Annunciation, in the year 1679, she made a vow of perpetual virginity. She was going to remain unmarried, be totally devoted to Christ for the rest of her life. And that she took a lot of heat for that, too. And when she went into the woods to pray, to go to her little makeshift chapel, there were all these rumors floating around about her. Oh, she's going there to meet a man in the woods. And people spread all kinds of vicious rumors about her. Well, she was going to meet Christ, you know, the spouse of her soul, the lover of her soul. And that's what she did. And she actually wanted to start a convent, if you will, for Native North American sisters in this place. But her spiritual director, who was one of these Jesuit priests who wrote the biography of her, Father Pierre Cholinek, he actually discouraged her and said, you know, this is not a good idea. And one of the reasons why he didn't want her to do that was because her health was really, really bad. The after effects of the smallpox, she was very weak and in poor health in general, and she kept inflicting these harsh penances, these mortifications on herself, and the priest tried to encourage her not to do that. Please, go easy on yourself. And she would just laugh at him and say, these are my acts of love. These are my acts of love for Jesus. She died on the 17th of April in the year 1680 during Holy Week, on Wednesday of Holy Week, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. She was 24 years old. And her last words were, in her native tongue, Jesus, I love you. Now, 15 minutes, this is a miracle that happened at her death. 15 minutes after she passed away, and these two Jesuit priests and all the indigenous people from the community that could fit into the cabin where she was dying, they were all there. They all saw this. 15 minutes after she died, the ugly scars from the smallpox that were on her face completely disappeared. Completely disappeared. And here's what one of the priests said, Father Pierre Cholinek, in the biography that he wrote of St. Kateri. This is how he narrates her death. And you're listening to the K.L. Clark Show on Relevant Radio. He said, the bell of the chapel was rung at 3 o'clock to gather the natives because they wanted to witness her death. After 3 o'clock, they returned, and Kateri waited until everyone had entered the cabin. When the last one had arrived, she went into an agony, and while everyone was kneeling around her, she pronounced these words, Jesus, Mary. Then she had a slight spasm, which one could see at the right side of her mouth, and she died as if she was falling into a light sleep. And we were for a long time not even certain whether she had died. And then her face suddenly changed and became in a moment so beautiful. Her face had the appearance of a rosy color, which she had never had, and her features were not the same. I saw this immediately. I was praying beside her body, and I cried out for my astonishment. Her face was so scarred with smallpox from the time she was 4 years old, and with all her infirmities and her mortifications contributed to ruin her even more. But now her face appeared more beautiful than when she had been alive. I will admit openly that my first thought which came to me was that she might have entered into heaven exactly at that moment and reflected back somehow in her chaste body a small ray of glory that she had gone to possess. The day that she died, we passed that day with an extraordinary devotion. She left the entire village with a fragrance of her virtue. And after that time, it became much easier for the indigenous peoples of the village to be open to Christianity. And so that's what he said about her. And that was an amazing account of her death. Her motto in life was, who can tell me what is most pleasing to God that I may do it? Who can tell me what is most pleasing to God so that I may do it? That's a great motto, to do God's will. Thy will be done. She really lived that out in her life. And when she was beatified in 1980 in St. Peter's Basilica, Pope John Paul II, in his homily, said this. He said, her beatification should remind us that we are all called to a life of holiness, for in baptism, God has chosen each one of us to be holy and spotless, and to live through love in his presence. Holiness of life, union with Christ through prayer and works of love, is not something reserved to a select few among the members of the church. It is the vocation of everyone. That we're all called to be saints. The Pope remind us of that. It's all throughout St. Paul's letters. We are called to be saints. And so that's the life of St. Kateri Tekakwitha, the first native-born North American saint. A lot of people don't know much about her life, but today is her feast day, and I thought it was really important to talk about it. And just as those horrible scars on her face were transformed after her death, the miracle, her face became absolutely radiant, beautiful. The scars faded away. We hope that through her prayers, that the scars of the mistreatment of the native peoples of North America, tragically at the hands of her fellow Catholics, that somehow those scars can be healed through the love and forgiveness of Christ, and that there can be true peace and reconciliation through Christ, the one who came to reconcile God to man, man to God, and us to each other as well. You're listening to The Cale Clark Show. We'll be right back with your phone calls after this message, 1-888-914-9149.
This is The Cale Clark Show, giving you the confidence you need to bring the faith into everyday life.
Hey, welcome back to our final segment on the show. I want to remind you, got a free gift for you. No shipping, no handling, totally gratis. Relevant Radio wants to send you our new book, Treasures of the Rosary, Reflections by Those Who Pray It Daily. And it's got some great meditations on the rosary from St. John Paul II. We talked about him before the break. He, of course, instituted those luminous mysteries, the mysteries of light, during his pontificate. Great set of mysteries, which we pray on Thursdays. And also reflections by St. Jose Maria Escrivá and our own Father Rocky, the CEO of Relevant Radio. He's got a lot to say about the rosary, and he prays it with us every night on the Family Rosary across America at 7 p.m. Central. I'll be there. Hope you can join me to pray along with Father tonight. Now, you'll get this again absolutely free, and it's only available for a limited time. We have a limited number of these, so you're going to want to grab it while you can get it. Sign up for your free copy today at relevantradio.com/treasures. That's relevantradio.com/treasures. We're going to go to the phones right now. Dominica is calling from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hi, Dominica. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you, Clark. I just wanted to make a comment. So I live in New Mexico, and you're talking about the First Nations possible prophet of the time where they taught him how to make the sign of the cross and stuff.
Yeah,
and so something similar happened here. Yeah, very. And something similar happened here in New Mexico, except it was with a Spanish nun. She was a Franciscan nun who lived in Spain. And so Maria de Agreda, she's known for her book, The Mystical City of God. She's the one that wrote that. And so there's Salinas Pueblo Missions. It's right east of Albuquerque.
Okay.
And so there's some ruins there and churches and stuff. But it's said, like in tradition and in her writings and everything, that she appeared to the Native Americans in that area. And the cool thing is when the Spanish missionaries came up, you know, with the conquistadores and everything, there was a group of Native Americans that actually went and met him asking for baptism, and they knew the basic rubrics of the faith and everything. So it's really cool. I just wanted to comment. So in case anybody didn't know about it, it's really neat.
So is it, Dominica, I don't know very much about Maria de Agreda. A lot of people have called in and brought her up. I should probably look into this. But is it alleged that she is it alleged that she bilocated and appeared to these
indigenous
correct, North Americans?
Because she never left Spain, but she appeared to the Native Americans here.
Mm-hmm. Somewhat like Padre Pio bilocating, that sort of thing. Yeah, it's interesting the way that God can reach anyone. He's beyond no one's reach. Obviously, through our natural world, we can tell that there's a powerful Creator God. St. Paul talks about that in Romans chapter 1. And I think of people also in closed countries to the gospel, in several Muslim countries, where very often the only way that God can reach these people is through dreams and visions. A lot of conversions in the Muslim world happen that way. And so I just think this is a fascinating topic of study, and this idea that indigenous prophets in what is now Canada and the United States may have received visions which prepared them for the message of Catholic missionaries. It just kind of blows my mind. And I hadn't heard that before reading that piece by Terry Glavin. So thanks for calling in with that, extra
welcome.
Little info on, and she is a blessed, is she not? Maria de Agreda?
Correct. She's blessed. And okay. So, but she is considered a mystic of her time. And her, if you've never read Mystical City of God, I highly recommend it.
Okay. I'll check into it because you're not the first person to bring her up. And again, I don't know much about her, but I'd like to learn more about this. So thanks, Domenica. I appreciate you listening and appreciate the call.
Thank you, Clark. Bye.
You got it. Okay, thanks. And that's okay. She can call me Clark. I've been called much worse. So call me Kale. Call me Clark. Call me Kale, Clark, Kent, whatever you want. 1-888-914-9149. Well, you know what? It's summertime now, as you know, and a lot of people are looking for things to do for their family. And with things kind of getting back to normal, a lot of people, a lot of parents especially, want to start rescheduling their kids into a lot of stuff. I saw two really interesting and complimentary pieces that came into my inbox. One was from a Catholic point of view, and the other was from a secular point of view. The secular point, and they were both basically saying the same things, which I thought were interesting from different points of view. One of them was from the New York Times, and it was written by Shalini Shankar. And you know, last week we were talking about the National Spelling Bee. She's the author of Beeline, What Spelling Bees Reveal About Generation Z's New Path to Success. That sounds interesting in and of itself. But Shalini Shankar, writing in the New York Times, she had a piece called A Packed Schedule Doesn't Really Enrich Your Child. And she talked about the fact that, obviously, when the extracurricular slash industrial complex came to a halt last spring with the pandemic, parents didn't know what to do. Their kids couldn't go to physical school buildings. How do you fill all these vast hours of unscheduled time for them? Obviously, there were some remote instructions and remote activities, but trying to keep children, quote unquote, busy became really tough for parents. So a lot of people, of course, turned to the screen. Give them the iPad. Give them your phone. Let them play a game. Let them watch a video. Let them have FaceTime chats with each other. And now that society is starting to reopen a little bit, a lot of parents are really tempted to go back to the way that they were doing things before the pandemic started. A full slate of language classes, sports, music lessons, other extracurricular activities. And as Shankar calls it, a guilt-free plan to keep kids busy with quote-unquote enriching activities while we get our jobs done. And she says, you know, that may not be the greatest idea in the world. Maybe we shouldn't go back to the way that we were doing things pre-pandemic with these hectic schedules for kids and for families. And in fact, research has shown that for Generation Z, the overscheduling of all these activities has been bad for them, has been bad for kids' mental health and for their stress. And so she's asking the question, what can parents do with their kids instead of maybe overscheduling them, especially in the summertime? Maybe teach them, and maybe we need to relearn this ourselves too, the value of what she calls unstructured time. Unstructured time, and she thinks we can spend a lot of that time with greater civic participation. And she's not arguing that we quit everything or anything like that, dance classes or putting your kids in sports programs, music, whatever. These are good things, but she argues that it's good to give children time to be bored. Because for a lot of kids today, they live in really only one of two states. They're either on scheduled time, they're in school or they're in an activity that's pre-scheduled, or they're on their screen. So it's either scheduled time or screen time, and those are their two states of being. And she doesn't think that's healthy. Shalini Shankar, she says that unstructured time, quote-unquote boredom time, could address this. And you could do a lot of different things. Go for a walk, read a book, learn how to cook, volunteer at an animal shelter or something like that. And she says a lot of the reasons why parents want to overschedule their kids is because they're trying to get them into universities. They're trying to, it's hyper-competitive, and it's almost like before you leave high school, these kids are supposed to have resumes brimming with skills, expertise, and accolades, as she puts it, to get into college. And parents are so worried about whether their kids are doing enough to stay competitive in college admissions. they sports parents are spending upwards of $500 a month, according to a 2019 survey. Some parents are spending over $1,000, jeopardizing their retirement to try to get their kids more cachet to get into schools. And Ms. Shankar says that a lot of Gen Z kids, they can see something that maybe their parents can't, which is the dangers of overwork. The dangers of overwork. And in fact, some notable figures are actually fighting against this. Naomi Osaka. I want to talk about this maybe another time in more depth, but Naomi Osaka, maybe the best female tennis player in the world, she recently chose to opt out of the French Open and then Wimbledon, two major tournaments, because she refused to participate in media sessions for her mental health. She was having some mental health issues. She says, I can't take it right now. No, no, you have to do this. Well, I'm out. She just quit. And it's pretty tough to pull off a legitimate tournament without the number one player in the world. Obviously, it can still be done, and it was done. But she started to maybe voice what a lot of people are thinking, that no matter how much you love your job may not love you back, as Shankar puts it. So there's more to life than working all the time. Now, work is very important. It's a great way to sanctify ourselves. But we have to also understand that this so-called boredom time can be valuable as well. And another piece that came into my inbox from a Catholic perspective, from the Catholic University of America, actually, a professor of law at the CUA, Lucia Selecchia, she wrote an article called Wasting Ordinary Time. Now, we're in ordinary time, of course, and summer is, in another sense, ordinary time. It's very ordinary. It's not extraordinary in a lot of ways. And she talked about how her summers were so idyllic when there was really nothing much to do. She said when she was a kid, summer tended to last forever. And the summer highlight was a family road trip, a week or two, all together in the station wagon, long-distance trips, biking in a nearby park, borrowing a lot of books from the county library, whiling away afternoons with her grandfather, long evenings in the backyard, eating more ice cream than she should have, sharing time with the people she loved. But she said summer seems different today. And the start of the school year tends to creep earlier and earlier every year. It used to start all the time after Labor Day, not in most places anymore. Now it's starting in August. Social media feeds that kids see. They see their friends taking expensive vacations and luxury experiences. How do you deal with that? The quest for the perfect college. That starts ever earlier, like I just talked about. And that New York Times piece mentioned that. Summers for kids are often used to study and to try to boost chances of getting into that perfect school. Summer sports camps are almost like pro athletic camps. Career prep for these quote-unquote campers. Expensive service trips, formal volunteer activities. She's kind of arguing, Lucia Selecchia, for a return to the ordinary times, the so-called boredom times of the summer. Because there's another way to learn. Not all wisdom, she says, comes from school. Sometimes it's good to quote-unquote waste an ordinary afternoon listening to elders talk about lessons that they learned when they came of age, the history of their lives, their experiences. Take a vacation with loved ones, going to a park, a quiet picnic, waste the day. Maybe you could even waste a social media post. Post something ordinary. It doesn't always have to be so crazy, like some exotic trip. That might encourage your less fortunate friends. And don't waste your child's summer with you, because soon enough they'll be out of the house and you're going to miss them. It's going to come all too soon. And so there's a lot of other things that we can do in these days, a whole new world. There's a lot of great adventures, special times in the summer that we can cherish, and the world might consider it wasted time, but it might be a sacred gift of the so-called ordinary time, and that's something to think about. I really enjoyed that piece, and I hope you enjoyed the Cale Clark Show today on Relevant Radio. It's always fun to be with you. And a little comment here from Twitter, from Adam and Sarah on Twitter, and they tweeted at me saying, to me, a schedule should be a combination of work, play, and quiet time. If we lose the quiet time, we lose the contemplation time. If we lose that, we lose valuable time with our Lord. That's really important. So thanks, Adam and Sarah, on Twitter for mentioning that. And it's true, like St. Kateri went out into the woods to kind of have that contemplative time with our Lord. We need that, because when we spend time with Jesus, then we can bring him with us. Well, he's always with us, but we're much more aware of his presence when we spend that quiet time with him. And then we can kind of go into these activities, whether they're intense or a little bit less intense in the summertime, and know that he's with us at all times. So I like that combination of work, play, and quiet time. We're not human doings. We're human beings. That's how God created us, in his image. And God rested too, right? So that's in the book of Genesis, and we've got to learn to do that as well. All right, before I go, I you saw this tweet that I posted. There is something called mac and cheese ice cream. I don't know whether this is one of the seven signs of the apocalypse or not. I'll have to go back to the book of Revelation, but that's not my way of getting a refreshing treat.
Sounds
in the summertime.
Terrible.
Yeah, I agree, Lucas.
Awful.
You told me about this, and I was just horrified. So follow my tweet, at Cale Clark. You can find out more information about that if that's something you might want to try out on this hashtag National Mac and Cheese Day. Well, hope it hasn't been too cheesy to spend time with me today. Lucas Holt produced, Patrick Alog screen the calls. Timmery's up next, followed by the happiest half hour of your day, the Family Rosary Across America. Take it away, Michaela.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.